Welcome to International Dispute Negotiation, your guide to resolving disputes everywhere.
This is Mike McElrath, and this podcast is about different ways of accepting and managing the risks of dispute resolution, presenting them through the eyes of experts from different countries and backgrounds.
Until 10,000 years ago, all human societies existed as autonomous villages or bands. 99.99% of cultural evolution has occurred within the last 10,000 years.
International Dispute Negotiation is a podcast about the different ways of resolving disputes that exist around the world. And there are differences, but one of the things that comes up a lot in these discussions are the commonalities, expectations of fairness and efficiency, codes of laws, judges, and yes, lawyers, pretty much everywhere you look. But did it have to be this way? Why not resolve conflict simply by, for example, beating each other with clubs? Well, during most of the 2 million years it took modern humans to evolve, that may have been, in fact, an acceptable way of resolving conflict. Our ancestors lived in small groups, and anyone unhappy with an outcome, well, they could just move somewhere else. But then, around 10,000 years ago, things began to change. We exchanged clubs for, at some point, lawyers handing out business cards. So how did this happen? On a recent trip to New York, I went to the American Museum of Natural History and asked.
I'm Robert Carnero. I'm curator of South American ethnology at this museum. My field work has been in Amazonia. I work with three different groups there, mostly with the Guicuru in central Brazil, with the Amawaka in eastern Peru, and I spent a month with the Yanomama in southern Venezuela.
Dr. Carnero is a cultural anthropologist. His work with small autonomous societies led him to form a leading theory on the formation of the state, which he argues occurred first in crowded places where moving away wasn't an easy option. Conflict and conquest occurred instead, leading to large groups. As these societies grew in size, chiefdoms into kingdoms into empires, they evolved formal dispute resolution systems, first by default, and then by design to keep them together and productive. In fact, his research suggests that the introduction of formal conflict resolution systems may simply be part of the natural order or sequence that takes place as judges, mediators, and lawyers emerge in the evolution of a society. So to answer the question, did it have to be this way, we delve into the dispute resolution methods of proto-societies and how they evolved into the mechanisms that we see around us in the world today.
Years ago, I was working on a project of trying to, using a technique called scale analysis, to try to determine the relative order of development of a whole bunch of traits. After the course of evolution, I mean, what regularities are there? To what extent do societies parallel each other in the way these...
And evolve the same way.
Yeah, and obviously... It's not perfectly regular, but this is a technique to get at whatever regularities exist.
Right.
Now, the traits are listed here in essentially a random order, and the societies are arranged in essentially random order. You read the literature for that society and put a plus down when the trait is present and a minus when it's absent. But after you have this matrix, you rearrange them so a society with a...
It's social stratification, pottery, fermented beverages, political state, agriculture, stone architecture, smelting of metal ores, and loom weaving. And these are what? These are the scale to determine the state of development of
determine in which order these traits were developed. Also to determine the degree of evolution of these particular societies here. And you rearrange them, as I said, so that society with the largest number of traits is at the bottom and the one with the smallest number of traits is at the top. And you rearrange the society so the society with the least number of traits is at the left-hand end and the one with the largest number is at the right-hand end. And when you do that, presto chango, you have this.
At this point, Dr. Carneiro opens up a chart that shows the order in which societies evolve certain characteristics. We see that laws begin to emerge fairly early. It's like looking at our professional origins.
With the Yalgan on the left, they had nothing, and then you
right.
The Incas on the right, they had all those things.
Yeah, this shows what this technique does. It enables you to derive the regularities in the evolution of this body of traits.
What did you find when you looked at the evolution of law and judicial process within societies?
Well, let's see. Okay, law and judicial process. Well, sumptuary laws, for example, is one such. Mm-hmm. Court of laws.
So you looked at how many societies here? It must be about...
There are 100.
100 societies. And only those that had a code of laws, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, fewer than 10 seem to have had a code of laws.
Yeah.
You have, for example, here... Characteristic 363 is specialized public executioner. You can imagine primitive societies having that. Oaths or affirmations of truthful testimony required of witnesses in legal trials. And you can see that in a more evolved state. But there's one here that it jumped out at me. It's number 351, mediation or formal legal procedure customarily used to settle at least one type of dispute within the political unit. And I noticed that this list was developed in 1965. Wow. What was it that you were looking at through mediation?
I guess through my reading of the ethnographic literature, I've been aware of cases where something that we call mediation, we later defined as mediation, occurred in some societies, a way of dealing with problems that arose.
And as you study the history of these groups, these organizations, and the coming together of political states, have you seen... ways of resolving disputes also evolving together with them?
Well, at a lower level, before chiefdoms are formed...
Even before the chiefdoms are formed.
Yeah. There are various ways. For example, some groups, like among the Kwikuru, there's a high premium on peacefulness, on not fighting. So if you have some grievance against somebody else, you don't confront him. You may tell other people, what bum this guy is, this is what he did to me, That's you diffuse it that way, but you don't fight the guy.
No direct confrontation.
Okay. There are other cases where you do have confrontation, and the best examples I can think of in Amazonia are the Kayapo in central Brazil and the Yanomama in southern Venezuela, where the Kayapo have club fights, and they have it's ritualized, it's called abentake, and men sometimes...
What kind of clubs?
Made out of hardwood. And they, if it's just two men who have the dispute, then the two men will face each other and exchange club blows.
So where? On the body or?
Well, on the upper arm especially, because broken bones often result from this.
And so they can do real damage.
Oh, yes. Yeah, they're not kidding. It's not ritual. It's really... It's got limits. It's not, you can't just hit anywhere as hard as you want, but within those limits, you could really give quite a blow.
And the one who's not hitting is just required to stand there and take a blow.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow.
And then back and forth until someone gives up or someone falls from the effect of the blows. Now, this can resolve the issue to the extent that, the open confrontation is over and the two individuals or the two factions continue to live in the village.
So it doesn't matter who's right and who's wrong.
Right. No, no, no.
Who can tolerate more pain,
exactly,
basically,
right,
or inflict more
pain. Because there's no one... See, at this level, you don't have a chief who or has a judicial function of deciding who's correct and who's not. It's just who's the strongest.
I would say there's a bit of a corollary in some forms of litigation that you see in some countries where the litigation costs are so high that often it's not who's right or who's wrong, but who falls first and who cannot put up with, and you see that some parties, how much can they cause and how much damage can they inflict in legal fees on the other side by keeping litigation going, and how much can they suffer themselves and see who falls first, really, and without regard necessarily to who's right and who's wrong.
Sure.
Yeah. So that's the Kayapo.
The Yanomama have four levels of dueling, you might say. Chest pounding being the lowest level. And again, they alternate hitting each other in the chest with a closed fist. At that level, they're out to hurt the other guy, but not do really very extensive physical damage.
Chest pounding, pound the other's chest.
The other's chest, yeah. Although I know of two cases where people have died as a result of it.
Was it really hit?
Yeah. The next level is club fighting, where they alternate hitting each other on the head with clubs. And I witnessed the results of one where a guy was looked more dead than alive when he was brought back from the other village. He had 6 gashes on his scalp.
Oh, wow.
But even there, you're not out to kill the guy. The next level is axe fight, where they have now Western axes, and they hit each other with a blunt end of the blade. But you're still not out to kill. But when the fourth level, then you are out to kill. Then you use bows and arrows.
Which is warfare.
Yeah. Well, no. It's not warfare because it's still within the village.
That's dispute resolution. It's internal conflict.
That's right. This is all internal.
That's the dispute resolution within the villages.
Yeah, between villages, generally, there's no such mechanism. It's open warfare then.
Right.
Yeah. But these disputes often lead to village splitting. That's one of the...
How would in the first Campbell, I guess, was the Kukudo, as you say, is the first group that resolves disputes. The Kikudo plays a high premium on not fighting and how would they then resolve a dispute if somebody was fighting over a piece of property or
well, I'll tell you,
rights to an animal or
what? The real source of difficulty among them is fear of witchcraft and accusations of witchcraft. I've personally known 3 men who have been executed as witches. So it's a serious matter.
Executed,
yeah. You think this guy is a witch. He's bewitched. He's killed someone close to you. You get the shaman to verify it. And in fact, they have a specialist. He's not in every village, but he's in 2 or 3 of them, who has a special way of divining the identity of a witch, supposedly. And if he fingers a certain individual, okay, then which you can say to this diviner, okay, continue the process until you kill him by magical means, or you can say, well, okay, you fingered him, that's enough for me, I'll take care of it. So what you do is you and a friend of yours wait until this guy's going off on a fishing expedition or something, and you trail him, and then you catch him alone in the woods and club him to death and bury his body there. You come back, no one says anything, but everyone knows what's happened.
Wow.
And as I say, that I've known personally 3 men to whom this has happened. And it's curious that the Kikuyu have they're very well off in many ways. Their principal difficulty is this particular thing, which is of their own creation, of course, because as far as I can tell, there's no real instance of practicing witchcraft. They can tell you exactly how it's done, but I don't have any information really that someone actually does it. But they're sure that people do it.
Well, why do you think that there were these such dramatic forms of dispute resolution that are so different? One with the indirect, no direct confrontation.
Well,
in other words, completely all direct, and it's all disputes are resolved.
Yeah.
Not by doing things behind the scenes, but by whacking each other on the head or on the chest.
When the case of the Kikuyu, I think this is speculation, but there's evidence that at one time, maybe 500 years ago, there were very large villages there, maybe up to 2,000, where it was, I'm sure, necessary to have mechanisms in place to prevent disputes and open fights and so on.
So it was the size of the area, the political size, which gave rise to a need to not...
Yeah, I suspect that that's true. Can't really be sure, but... I think it's the villages of 2,000, as may have existed here in the Upper Xingu, are not typical of Amazonia. Usually villages, 100, 200 is about the average or the maximum size.
I see. So as societies grow larger and more complex and there's more interaction among the participants, there's a need for a different form of dispute.
Yeah.
A different way of resolving disputes among the people.
Let me give you an example of what happens sort of at the upper end. The Aztecs, of course, had an actual state and were large. They had a market which was very large. The Spaniards were amazed. They said, this market is larger than the one in Salamanca or some other large Spanish city. And I think even there was supposed to be 50,000 there at one time. Obviously, with that many people brought together in the market conditions, there had to be some kind of regulation of it. And there were actual courts to adjudicate disputes in the market. There were a guy who was in charge of weights and measures to make sure that someone wasn't cheating. There was a courtesan, a judge, a police force to see to the law and order prevail throughout the market. So, in other words, as markets grow, as almost any kind of social group grows, you need the need for regulation, integration, coordination, control becomes more and more important. Go ahead.
Well, you shared with me an article that you'd written that talks about what the ingredients for conflict. It's the pairs of individuals. So, for example, the number that you give is in a village of 50 individuals. It's not as if there were 25 pairs, and two for, you know, but rather 1,225. How many relationships between the groups can exist, meaning this person and that person, or these two people, or these 10 people, and those two, or those one
or
five?
Dyads, anthropologists sometimes call.
How many oppositions?
Yeah, potential oppositions.
Or as a lawyer, how many two-sided cases could you have with 50 people?
Yeah, right. Anyway. And that number increases almost as the square of the population.
In fact, I'm noting for 50 people, it's 1,225 for 100. It'd be 4,950 pairs. All the way up, you have here 800. So 800 individuals, 319,600 pairs. So 319,600 opportunities for conflict.
And there are always things over which people can have fight about. When you get to a village of 800 with so many pairs of individuals, you're almost sure to have some conflict. And either they're resolved in some way that the disputants stay together in the village, or else the village splits apart. And village splitting is a universal phenomenon. You go back into virtually every autonomous village and you'll find a history of the village having split sometime in the past.
So it's interesting. It seems as if, you know, as you get above 800 or 1,000 or more, it's almost you get to the point, if it's certainly in the millions, it's you're creating an environment where you need lawyers.
Their method of conflict resolution is split apart.
Right.
I mean, they could presumably stay there and club each other to death until no one's left or just a few. But instead, they split up. Maybe they have a fight beforehand. Maybe they don't split up and then go their separate ways.
But if you're going to keep them together, if you get all these different people living in the same place,
then you've got to have some mechanism to do it.
So it's sort of an effective way of resolving disputes presumably without thumping each other on the chest, which inflicts damage. That works in the smaller groups.
But there comes a point where you need some official mechanisms, some formal mechanisms to enforce this, at least control the violence that might result. Political evolution entails the creation of a number of formal mechanisms for doing all kinds of things, like in the case of trade, markets develop.
Have you noticed, are there any, in these studies, any competitive advantages of groups that have one form of resolving disputes versus come up against other groups that have a different form of resolving disputes? Size, I guess, is one. If you can have a larger society, you're more likely to run over a small one.
Absolutely,
right?
That's why where you get chiefdoms arising, then it becomes a chiefdom of maybe a dozen villages against an autonomous village. And there, this proportion size is so great that gives all the edge to the chiefdom. And so once you get chiefdoms beginning to occur, the process grows rather rapidly. And pretty soon the entire area becomes an area of chiefdoms because the autonomous village is at a great disadvantage. For example, the Inca Empire. after a certain point, the Inca Empire became so much stronger than any of the surrounding petty kingdoms that they could conquer them easily. And it got to the point where they didn't even have to conquer them, they could just intimidate them, you know. This small autonomous kingdom, faced with the might of the Inca Empire, would readily submit. So anyway, the Inca Empire was enlarging itself by conflict, and successful conflict, by defeating the contending unit. But at the same time, they were developing greater and greater need within this growing empire.
Because they're bigger, larger, they've got different systems, empires that they've swallowed, and so they had to work together.
Yeah, and actually the Inca Empire developed more and more intelligently than the Roman Empire. Okay, the Roman Empire, a general would go out and there'd be a fight against some neighboring kingdom whom they defeat, and then come back with 50,000 slaves. All right, they'd be put to work, but there were always slave rebellions, and you had the problem of what to do with these people who have been slaves, and they want to break apart. The Inca Empire did not have slavery. They would incorporate everyone as more or less citizens of the Inca, as soon as they conquered them, and then they had a system of corvée instead of slavery. So if the Inca wanted to extend their highway system to a newly conquered area, what they would do is draft every 10th man in each village that they had conquered, set him to work for a month or two on this highway. Then he'd go back to the village, and another guy would be brought to him. So it never was a very great hardship on the village, since they still had 90% of their manpower always there, and yet they got the job done. My contention is that only through warfare and conquest as a result that you begin to get larger and larger political units. Until that happens, they still remain small autonomous villages. Unfortunately, the failure of conflict resolution, except by open hostility and conquest, that you begin to get these large things, but that you are creating these larger units by conflict, you are creating within the increasing political units, they become larger and larger, more complex, and more in need of having mechanisms for binding them together, for consolidating them, making them integrated. And as a matter of fact, it was on the basis of things that I was finding or not finding among the Kukuru that I was led to formulate a theory of why the state emerged, wherever it did. Sometimes it's called the circumscription theory. If you look at the areas of the world where the state first emerged, the Indus Valley, the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, the Nile Valley, the Valley of Mexico, or in the Andes, they are areas of circumscribed agricultural land. Take Amazonia. There you have a very wide expanse of land, anywhere, any place in which you can farm. So that warfare, while it occurred there, led to a process of what you might call fight and flight, so that villages spaced themselves out at arm's distance. And so if village A defeated village B, it couldn't incorporate it because village B could flee. In the Andean areas, for example, if you look at the coast of Peru, it's one of the most arid deserts in the world. You have a whole bunch of little valleys that come down from the Andes. All right, population settled there, began farming, gradually increased in numbers, and fought among themselves up to a point. After a while, they found that there was no place to go. Defeated groups had no place to flee. And then you
because
begin...
Because there is geological...
Right, you have on the...
Boundaries.
In back you have the mountains, on either side you have the desert, then you have the sea on the other side. So that then the warfare that ensued led to the subjugation of the stronger groups, of the weaker groups by the stronger, and imposing their will on them so that you get these chiefdoms where a paramount chief has permanent control over a number of villages. And as this process continued, the competition was not autonomous village against autonomous village, but chiefdom against chiefdom. And ultimately led in most of the valleys, or many of them anyway, to a process of political consolidation. And if it was large enough, you'd get something that's pretty close to a state, or even reaching state level. And then eventually you have a valley kingdom against another valley kingdom, and you get multi-valley kingdoms, and eventually the Inca Empire, which is a very covered a very large area. It had perhaps 10 or 12 million people.
Do you think that people, now when you have these complexities and the people have to live and work and survive in these social cultural systems, do you think people have also evolved as a consequence?
You mean genetically?
Genetically, yeah.
I don't think so, because until 10,000 years ago, all human societies existed as autonomous villages or bands. The 99.99% of cultural evolution has occurred within the last 10,000 years, too short a period for genetic differences to occur, for genetic evolution really to manifest in itself.
So we're working within these systems. That's interesting. We're working within these systems with a bit of a Stone Age.
Yeah, our psychology is what we were like in the Stone Age in the Upper Paleolithic.
So we're Stone Age people dealing with very sophisticated modern dispute, culturally evolved dispute systems.
Yeah. And there's, so many aspects of mental illness. I mean, the stresses that the human nervous system is subjected to in our culture are much greater and of a different kind than existed 10,000, 20,000 years ago.
If you were an anthropologist from outer space, were to come to the Earth, would you study legal systems as a manifestation of culture?
I sort of depends what I had been used to back on Mars or wherever to see what would interest me. But one would be impressed by a very large group that functioned as a society, integrated. What realizing the difficulties involved in keeping, say, 300 million people as one functioning society. How is that done? What kinds of institutions do you have to permit this to happen?
And how do you do it in France or in China?
Yeah, right. No, I think that there's nothing like comparative studies to learn things. How does each country do it? In what way are they same? In what way? There's some things that have to be done in pretty much the same way. Other things allow for a certain amount of variation.
Well, listen, thank you very much.
Well, you're certainly welcome.
You've been listening to International Dispute Negotiation. This podcast is presented by the International Institute for Conflict Prevention and Resolution, CPR. CPR is a membership-based nonprofit organization that promotes excellence and innovation in public and private dispute resolution, providing an international resource for the avoidance, management, and resolution of business disputes. For further information about CPR, or to download archived versions of this podcast, go to www.cpradr.org. Questions about this podcast or the issues discussed can be addressed to idn@cpradr.org. The music of Note Noir is used with permission.